Lyme disease is the most common tick-borne illness in North America, and the number of reported cases has been steadily climbing over the last decade. Here to explain how the disease is spread, diagnosed, and treated, and how we can protect ourselves while we're outside this summer are Dr. Brian Fallon, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Diseases Research Center at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Carolyn Britton, Associate Professor of Clinical Neurology at Columbia University Medical Center. She is the Chief Neurologist for Columbia's Lyme Research Studies. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Brian, most of us know we get Lyme disease through tick bites. Only deer ticks?
It's the Gesodes scapularis. Yeah, it's the tick that's primarily carried by the deer as well as the mice, yes.
But mice as well.
Yes.
Are they affected by the disease or do they just carry the ticks?
Well, the deer could be affected and certainly other mammals that get infected could be affected, such as dogs. They can get arthritis as well.
But the ticks are carriers. What are they carrying?
The ticks are carrying a bacterial organism called a spirochete, Borrelia burgdorferi, and it's actually in the mice. So it's the fact that the ticks are actually biting the mice, sucking the blood of the mice, and then with bringing in the blood, it's bringing in the bacterium, and so the ticks carry that bug, and then when they bite a human being, they pass it on to the human being.
I want to get into the whole business of the spirochete later, but when was this disease first discovered?
It was in the mid-1970s in Lyme, Connecticut.
And that's why it's called Lyme disease.
That's right. But
it must have been around way before then.
Absolutely. It's been around quite a long time. So actually, in the Museum of Natural History, there was a mouse study that was in one of the drawers from the late 1890s that actually had a Borrelia spirochete in it. So we know that it's been in the United States for a long time. It's also been in Europe for a very long time.
And did people know immediately that it was caused by tick bites?
Well, in Europe, they did know that there was a type of Lyme disease caused by ticks, but they didn't exactly know whether it was a virus or what was causing it.
And what parts of the world is it most prevalent?
It's very common in the United States, in the Northeast, especially in the Midwest, the California coastal states, but it's actually located throughout the United States. It's also located heavily in Europe, in Germany, northern Italy, in Sweden, Norway. It's also heavy in the Balkan states as well as in Russia.
And do we know where it originated?
No.
So it could have been brought over from Europe, or it could have been, well, we could have sent it over to Europe.
Possibly. More likely it came from Europe because it was reported there earlier.
Carolyn, what are the symptoms?
Well, the symptoms vary. The initial symptom may be a rash. At the initial tick bite, a person may see a rash that may enlarge. The classic one is called the bullseye rash, where you have an enlarging red lesion, or it may be darker if you're brown skin, with central clearing. But that's the most typical location. Other types of rashes have been described. So if you have a typical bullseye, then you can infer, if you don't see the tick, that you've had a tick bite. But some of the less typical rashes are not noted to be due to Lyme. And there may be no symptoms other than that. If you develop symptoms initially, which about half of people will have nothing, many people will not even have a rash, and so the tick bite is inapparent or occult if they present with something later. And the initial symptoms may be very much like the flu, where you'll have fatigue, you'll have malaise, you'll have joint pains. And the neurologic symptoms can occur, usually in the minority of cases, but when they occur, it may be meningitis with headache and stiff neck and fever, or an encephalitis, rarely with seizures or confusion.
Now, if we have a bullseye rash, does that mean we've been bitten by an infected tick or just a tick?
Well, the likelihood, if you look at the studies up here in the Northeast, the range of the number of ticks, percentage of ticks that are infected varies from region to region. But a recent study up here in the Northeast in two areas in Suffolk County and in Westchester showed that about 70% or more of ticks are infected in those areas. And the thing that is really quite serious is that they actually can be infected with multiple organisms. About 20% will have multiple organisms or more. So
What do you mean by multiple organisms?
Well, other than the organism that causes Lyme, there is another organism that causes anaplasma or ehrlichia, and another called Babesia that infects red cells, which are likely underreported because they usually are not looked for. And the symptoms may overlap those of Lyme and may complicate a Lyme infection.
How soon do these symptoms even start showing up?
Usually, sometimes within days. If a person gets a tick bite, within days they may develop symptoms if they're going to develop an acute clinical syndrome. But it will often mimic a viral-type syndrome with muscle aches, joint aches, fatigue, malaise. So nothing distinctive that tells you it's Lyme if you didn't have a rash to recognize that you had had a tick bite or taken a tick off yourself, so you might think that you had the flu. Then they may become more enduring, and particularly joint pains become very prominent. In children in Lyme, the children who were seen then were diagnosed often as having juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. They developed disabling arthritic syndromes, and some even with cardiac involvement. So the symptoms can be very severe if it's unrecognized and untreated.
Are certain people more susceptible to Lyme disease than others?
I don't know that there is a differential susceptibility. The prevalence, Brian, you might want to address that. The prevalence of people, if you go to endemic areas, because he's done those serologic studies to find it, testing people for Lyme. Brian, do you want to address that?
I mean, certainly children are heavily at risk because they're out playing in the garden and the woods. So we know that there's a high rate of Lyme disease among kids. And for some reason,
Are their immune systems less developed? Is that another reason?
No, it's not the reason. I think it's more likely that they're out there playing in the brush, they're playing in the leaf litter, and that's where the ticks like to hang out.
My guests are Dr. Brian Fallon, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Diseases Research Center at Columbia University Medical Center. Also from Columbia University Medical Center is Dr. Carolyn Britton, Associate Professor of Clinical Neurology. She is also served as the chief neurologist for the Lyme research studies conducted by Columbia's Lyme and Tick-Borne Diseases Research Center. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Your calls about Lyme disease, today's topic on Please Explain. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So, Brian, what should people do if they have a rash and think that they've been bitten by a tick?
Well, it's certainly true that if you have a rash that is likely a Lyme rash, you should go to your physician, and the physician should treat you with antibiotics.
What happens if we have been bitten by a tick but don't have a rash?
Well, if you're bitten by a tick and don't have a rash, then it could be that the tick itself didn't actually carry the organism that causes Lyme disease. Or it could be that the rash will develop at a later point. But generally the recommendation is for tick bite, if it's been less than 24 hours, that you're probably very unlikely to get infected.
And what about getting the tick off? JP in New Jersey asks, will submerging the tick in water make it release?
Not a good idea. You don't want to do anything that will upset the tick, because otherwise the tick will then vomit its contents right into your bloodstream. So it's a terrible thing. Don't attach a cigarette. Don't try to burn it off or suffocate it with Vaseline. Don't do anything like that. Just take tweezers, pluck under the head, and pull it out very gently. And that's the best way to remove it.
Well, we don't always have tweezers with us on when we're walking through the woods.
That's true. So do your best with your fingernails.
How is Lyme disease diagnosed, Carolyn? Are there certain tests?
There are tests. It is typically diagnosed by blood tests. And there are two types of blood tests that are done. The routine screening test is called an ELISA, and that screens for many of the proteins that are present in Lyme. Also would recognize some proteins that may not be specific to Lyme alone, and that is then supplemented with a test that has greater specificity called a Western blot. And the Western blot test identifies specific proteins, those that are really highly specific to Lyme, the Lyme organism, Borrelia burgdorferi, and as well as some nonspecific proteins that may cross-react with proteins from other things. So many physicians will do a Lyme ELISA alone, but we usually follow up with a Western blot if there's a suspicion from symptoms that the person has been exposed. If there's a high epidemiologic risk and a consistent clinical syndrome, the ELISA may not be sufficient. In some cases, it may be negative, and a person will have a positive Western blot screen.
So if either of them could be unreliable, isn't there a third test,
the polymerase chain reaction? The polymerase chain reaction, and that is a highly specific test, but it's not sensitive. That is, that if it is negative, it does not exclude the diagnosis. But it is highly helpful when positive. It does mean that you do have the genetic material in your bloodstream and would support an active infection, the diagnosis of an active infection.
Is research being done, Brian, for better, more reliable tests?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the biggest conundrums with Lyme disease right now, and actually a source of a lot of the controversies in Lyme disease.
Because some people say they have Lyme disease and they're told by doctors that they don't.
Exactly. So some people have very well-documented Lyme disease and they have persistent symptoms and they don't know if they still have persistent infection. Or some people may not have the classic symptoms of Lyme disease, but they in fact do have Lyme disease and maybe they don't test fully positive on the standard tests. Also, it's very well known that in the first 2 or 3 weeks of infection, the blood test 50% of the time will be falsely negative. So with early Lyme disease, the blood tests are really terrible.
So if we're getting false negatives, do we not treat it? Or
if you see that rash, you've got to treat it. If your physician
and what is the standard treatment?
Standard treatment is 2 to 3 weeks of oral doxycycline for the early Lyme disease at the time of the rash.
And how effective is that?
It's quite effective, actually. I mean, there'll be a small number of patients who go on to develop persistent symptoms or relapse after that. But about 90% of patients will do very well as long as you catch it early. If you don't catch it early, it's much harder to treat.
Carolyn, why is Lyme disease called a great imitator?
Because it causes a tremendous number of syndromes. There are few syndromes like that in medicine. Systemic lupus is among those also cause the same. For instance, neurologically, if you say, what can you get neurologically? Well, you can get everything from a headache disorder to a Bell's palsy, which is a very common clinical presentation for acute Lyme especially, to a brachial plexitis, to an inflammation of the spinal cord and weakness of the legs, to a Guillain-Barré syndrome, to meningitis, and encephalitis. So and then there's a chronic progressive encephalopathy or chronic encephalopathy that also occurs. So it causes a great number of clinical syndromes neurologically. Multiple areas of the nervous system can be attacked. And so and some people have also, even in the peripheral nervous system, what's called neuropathy, there are different types of neuropathic symptoms that can occur in patients. Some people have a chronic pain syndrome or what is called a chronic sensory neuropathy. Others have a chronic progressive polyneuropathy with rather dramatic weakness. And the systemic symptoms that you can see occurring with this are arthritic syndromes, and in some patients who have cardiac involvement, a carditis. So really any number of symptoms, and they can mimic those clinical syndromes of other causes. So that's where assessing for epidemiologic risk for Lyme is very important in a tick endemic area.
Well, the Lyme bacterium, Borrelia burgdorferi, is a spirochete. Isn't syphilis also a spirochete?
It is.
Do they have any things in common?
Well, syphilis causes complex symptoms as well, in that you have this early skin lesion in syphilis, which if it is missed, then goes into a secondary stage and then into a tertiary stage where patients can develop a whole host of symptoms, including neurologic symptoms of dementia, spinal cord syndromes, a very severe neuropathy where they develop secondary joint problems as a consequence of that. So, yes, in that there's an early symptom and then late symptoms when the early stage is missed. So similar thing happens in Lyme disease.
Brian, what's late disseminated Lyme disease?
Late disseminated really refers to the fact that the spirochete has disseminated through the body and that it's occurring late. meaning months to years after the initial infection.
And it attacks the nervous system.
It can attack the nervous
system. As syphilis
does. Right, the central nervous system or the peripheral nervous system, as well as the joints or the heart.
Do we see sometimes psychological
effects? Yes. In fact, if you look at the early studies on Lyme disease, the very early studies where they were reporting a large series of cases, about a third of the patients reported prominent irritability, sleep disturbances, and depression associated.
So if somebody is having these neurological problems, are there tests? Do MRIs or PET scans help?
That's a good question. MRI scans can sometimes be helpful. Sometimes, especially with children, you might see hyperintense lesions on the MRI scan. Spinal taps can be very helpful, especially if they're abnormal, because if they're abnormal, that would be very supportive or indicative of the Lyme infection. And PET scans, at this point, clinically are not that helpful, although for research purposes, they tell us a lot about what's going on in the brain.
We'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll take listener calls and comments and also address the whole issue of chronic Lyme disease, because that remains one of the more controversial aspects of this discussion. My guests on Please Explain today are Dr. Brian Fallon and Dr. Carolyn Britton. Remember, our number here is 212-433-9692. Our comments can be left on our show page at WNYC.org. Here's a reminder that today is the deadline to enter our listener contest judged by award maven Patricia T. O'Connor. For more information about how to enter your picture of a sign that doesn't make sense, go to our show page at WNYC.org and then tune in on Wednesday and we will reveal the winners and talk to them. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with our discussion of Lyme disease on today's Please Explain with Drs. Brian Fallon and Carolyn Britton. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. We've got a number of people writing in. One person said that he was up in northern Vermont and asked if there were ticks and was told that they were too far north. Is that correct? Could that be true?
That's absolutely not correct. There are ticks all the way up in Canada. In fact, Vermont has a rising incidence of Lyme disease.
Another listener asks, if you squeeze the tick with tweezers, won't that squirt the contents into your bloodstream? Carolyn?
Well, you have to do it gently. It really is just about grasping it just barely and tugging it out, not to squeeze it till it's squashed. But it's the same principle, is not trying to burn it or crush it, but to really try to gently tug it off. So you just want to gently apply the tweezers to it and pull it off.
Although I'm assuming that if it's attached to you, it's already injected something into your body.
Likely. It depends on the duration of the attachment, though. If it's there for several hours, it's likely that it has already injected.
Jim in Litchfield says, once you had Lyme disease, are you less symptomatic the next time you're exposed?
No, you can absolutely get Lyme disease again, and the fact that you've had it before is not protective.
That's one of the difficult things about this infection. Many infections are that way. It's interesting. We produce antibodies. Our bodies produce proteins to fight the infections when we get them. And unlike when you're vaccinated, you don't get protection from these antibodies against reinfection. And that becomes an issue in looking at patients with recurrent disease, trying to decide whether they had new infection or whether they have a relapse of their previous infection. Because if they're at risk once for wherever they live, they're at risk, you know, all the time.
Let's take some calls. Ginny from the Bronx, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, actually, I think you just answered my question. I was diagnosed exactly a year ago with Lyme disease. I had the rash. I took the antibiotic, and I was fine afterwards. I would like to know if there was any possibility of being diagnosed again, since you do always, from my understanding, test positive from that point on. If I ever were to have symptoms that seemed like what I had before, but maybe without the rash the next time, how would I know what to be treated with?
I mean, that's a good question. You certainly will have positive blood tests for a number of years, actually. But what you should see is that the quantity of antibodies as studied by the ELISA should decline over time so that the next time you get an infection, the ELISA will jump up again.
We thank you for your call. A listener asks, Francesco in Montclair, are the ticks kept away if one uses bug spray?
Absolutely. If you apply a repellent to your skin and to your clothes that contains DEET, the ticks will not be attracted to you. And you can also spray your lawns as a protective service for your children and your family.
Now, what about vaccines? Aren't they using a vaccine in Germany? Is there one available here?
There has been. There actually was a vaccine here that SmithKline had developed a number of years ago, but they took it off the market for a variety of reasons. In Europe, they're developing a number of vaccines and promises that probably in the next 10 years there will be another vaccine here.
In fact, Anne left a comment. She said, my husband and I both had the vaccine and a booster several years ago. It was useless. We've both had Lyme since, and the vaccine left its remains in our system, so we always test positive. Any way to get around that? Carolyn?
That's interesting. Yes. No, that happens to patients. But there are some unique proteins that sometimes will be present. I think it's, what is the?
It's the OspA, 31.
OspA, yeah. Yes. Thank you, 31. My mind just went blank. OspA protein 31 will be present during an acute infection. That's not in that Lyme thing. Generally, the Lyme vaccine was not effective in preventing reinfection here, so that was the reason it was taken from the market, as well as reports of patients having problems with the vaccine itself.
Now, why wouldn't a vaccine be possible? Is this like HIV? Does it have many variations?
Well, it's not clear to me exactly why this is not effective, why it's not effective, but it's the case for a number of infections that don't mutate the way HIV does. And HIV, Lyme actually reminds me a lot of HIV in the way that it behaves, and that you can have periods of time where the virus is where it's present and very active, except in the case of Lyme, it actually goes very dormant. In HIV, untreated, you really have a chronic active infection with active replication all the time. So it's much more difficult in this case. It is just that for many infections, even though you don't have high mutability of the infections, you have ways in which the antigens in the infecting process mask themselves from the immune system so that the antibodies that are produced are never effective at completely blocking that infection from taking hold again, because it can sort of fold its proteins differently and certain critical antigenic determinants are not open for exposure to the immune system. So that may have part of it to do, just the steric properties of the organism.
Let's take another call. Tanya from Irvington. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I was treated for chronic Lyme over a period of years, several years ago, and I have been fine for a number of years. But my question is, will I ever completely get rid of the bacteria, given that it had advanced quite far and it wasn't treated initially? Or will I always be at risk of having it recur from within my own system? And I'm particularly concerned about the cognitive issues and the question of whether treatment ever really could cross the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah, one of the big questions is, why do patients have chronic symptoms or persistent symptoms? And one possibility is that they have a small amount of persistent infection that is still there. Another possibility is that the infection is no longer present, but the immune system has been activated in a certain way and is falsely or incorrectly targeting your peripheral nerves or your central nervous system, and maybe that's why you're having some of your ongoing symptoms.
Well, can you explain the controversy surrounding chronic Lyme disease? Aren't there some doctors who don't believe that it is a real condition?
I'll start, and then I'm sure Carolyn will have a lot to add as well. Chronic Lyme disease as a term is a term that creates a lot of distress amongst the physician community, the infectious disease community, and the patient community. Patients are extremely anxious about having chronic symptoms, understandably. The infectious disease doctors aren't quite sure exactly whether it's persistent infection or not. Many believe that it's not persistent infection, so they don't like the term chronic Lyme disease, and they use a term called post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. But what everybody agrees upon is that people, in fact, do have chronic symptoms. And so what the patient community urgently wants, what we're trying to do at the Columbia Lyme Center, and I think what all physicians want, is better tests to help us figure out who has persistent infection and who doesn't, as well as better treatments so that we can help those patients get better, regardless of what the cause is.
Right. I agree. I think that this is a really thorny issue. Fortunately for the caller, I'd like to say most patients, once they get treated and can be successfully treated, actually are going to have an enduring response. So a smaller number are going to go on to have relapsing clinical syndrome or be at risk for that, because your antibiotics, if you were on many of the typical ones like doxycycline or rifampicin, they do cross the blood-brain barrier.
Hear that?
So that is one thing. But the other issue is what is going on in terms of the mechanism of the problem. For me, I think that you always start with what's bothering the patient, and it is less important to me what term we call it. And so getting into an argument about whether you should call Lyme disease or not Lyme disease, I think gets us away from the point that there clearly are people who've had Lyme, who, as Brian said, go on to have a very debilitating illness. And our task as clinicians and researchers is to try to determine which are those who are due to ongoing infection, which may be a portion, that have ongoing infection or lab or infection. And we certainly have seen a few very well-documented cases where that has been the case, where even organisms have been isolated. Others may have other more complex mechanisms at work, and I think that we have to get up. Some may have autoimmune mechanisms at work. Others may have our constant activation of the central nervous system, which is thought to play a role in some of the clinical problems with HIV infection, where you activate all of these things as a result. You turn it on and it doesn't turn off. Your body's making all of these chemicals that basically cause you to have symptoms. So I think a lot of the work in many different directions really has to help. It would be very helpful to have a diagnostic tool that absolutely identifies everyone who's infected. But, you know, in medicine, we have very few absolutes. And I really do think that sometimes we have to use both the clinical research where it is and clinical judgment and the trait and the patient status to try to help us to understand what we need to do. And sometimes we are using empirical trials because we lack these diagnostic tests to help us to define exactly what's going on.
Lynn from Long Island, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to commend Dr. Fallon and Dr. Britton, who I've had the pleasure of meeting at different points about their trying to raise awareness of Lyme disease. In my daughter's case, she was an asthmatic and on steroids at the time that she was infected with Lyme. And at the time that she initially had Lyme treatment right after her infection, what happened with her was that the steroids covered her symptoms for many years until she came off of the steroids and then all of a sudden had a full-blown case of neurologic Lyme disease with an accompanying movement disorder. I think it's very important for there to be awareness in the medical community and also among parents, because children are most at risk, and children also have a large percentage of the chronic asthma that's around, that when children are infected with Lyme, they should not be on steroids. And I've seen very little knowledge about that out in the medical community.
I mean, that's certainly been observed in some of the early studies of Lyme disease, that patients who were concurrently given steroids tended to have more prolonged course of disease, more challenging outcomes.
A listener writes that her mother, who lives in Lyme, Connecticut, has gotten Lyme disease 5 or 6 times. Her husband has only gotten it once or twice. Is there anything you can do with diet or other things to keep the ticks away, or are ticks more likely to bite one person than another? I know that some people are more likely to be bitten by mosquitoes than others.
Well, if you're a heavy producer of carbon dioxide, the ticks will come flocking to you. So it could be that the wife is just naturally is producing more carbon dioxide, exuding more carbon dioxide, and the husband less, and that's why the ticks are coming.
Really?
Or it could be that Why do some people get sick and others don't? Obviously, there have to be genetic predispositions in some people that make them more vulnerable than others.
A listener asks if repellents other than DEET are effective. Is lemongrass effective?
I'm not aware of that. Are you, Carolyn?
I am not. I don't know. DEET is one that there's the most experience with and knowledge about, so I don't know.
Let's put Hank on the air. Hank is from Cedar Grove, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to clear up a technique for removing the tick, which I think was being referred to with the use of the tweezers or your fingernails. What, in fact, has to be done is that you have to grab the skin, which encases the head, and quickly pinch it out. So you're surgically removing a tick in one chunk, and you're left with, of course, a small wound that can be dealt with anesthesia.
I don't know what happened to that call, but
I mean, the key point is not to squeeze the abdomen of the tick, because that's the main point.
Then you're just squeezing all that stuff into your body.
Exactly. He's emphasizing it should be done quickly, and I think that's correct.
Rick from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I don't know. I missed the first part of the program, so I don't know how much you went into the life cycle of the tick, but I was just curious to know how much less at risk you were by hiking around in the forest in the wintertime in colder months.
Well, you're much less at risk. The ticks are much less active at that time. The primary periods of infection would be the spring, when the nymphs are very active and they're so small you're likely not to see them, right? And the adults are active in the fall when they're much bigger and they're readily visible. But the ticks are not very active at wintertime. You can get bitten, but much less likely.
Sandra in the Bronx writes that she's an avid hiker and she's had Lyme disease and had a bad reaction to one of the antibiotics she was prescribed. Is there any way to know how you will react to the cure beforehand? Also, she wants to know if she's doomed to some horrible neurological disease.
You know, the good news from an infectious disease point of view, some of my graduate work was in microbiology, is as many pathogens as we are exposed to, we have been artfully created so that we actually do not get as sick. So that she is going to do fine in all likelihood. With regard to drug allergy, typically you don't know you're allergic to a drug before exposure, unless you are related to something that's allergic to something that's related to that drug, and it would require testing, which is not usually practical. So most people get a medication, discover they're allergic on exposure to the medication.
Now, we have very little time left, but why do you think the number of infections is growing? Does that mean that more and more ticks are carrying the disease?
Well, it has to be due with the explosion of the mouse population and the deer population.
And also the ticks are carried by birds. So if you follow the bird migration pathways, let's say just in New York State, for example, up Lake Champlain, you'll see the Lyme disease epidemic is spreading up there. So it really has to do with the fact that the ticks are carried by a great number of mammals and birds.
Is there a website that people can go to for more information?
Absolutely, www.columbia-lyme.org.
And I want to thank both of you for participating in today's Please Explain Look at Lyme Disease. Dr. Brian Fallon, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Diseases Research Center at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Carolyn Britton, Associate Professor of Clinical Neurology at Columbia University Medical Center. It's been a great pleasure talking with both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
On Monday's show, historian William Jelani Cobb looks at how Barack Obama was elected in 2008, despite the fact that much of the established black leadership since the civil rights era openly supported Hillary Clinton. And he argues that the term post-racial is harmful and inaccurate. And then, the man discusses the lengths he and his cousin went to in order to get a kidney transplant. Also, music journalist Rob Sheffield on coming of age in the 1980s. And we'll talk to Knopf's Sonny Mehta about why the posthumous translations of Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy has been such a runaway success. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Paula Crossfield, Andrew Katchen, Matt Gurry, Matt Joseloff, and contributing producer Barbara Kahn. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.